Today, Taking the Toll, the DFA Daily to the 18th of May 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World Notice Post, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. We're now getting flows of data to help triangulate the true impacts of the virus and the economic deep freeze, and the more they come, frankly, the worse it gets. Before we start, a quick reminder that tomorrow, Tuesday, I'll be running my latest live stream at 8 p.m. Sydney, where we'll be updating our property and finance scenarios and answering questions real time. You can ask live via the YouTube chat or beforehand via the DFA blog. The links are below. And I already have accumulated some really interesting topics to discuss. APRA reported that superannuation drawdowns have now taken on average 3.3 business days to pay after receipt of the application from the Australian Tax Office, and that 94.4% have been made within 5 business days. And over the week to the 10th of May, superannuation funds made payments to 379,000 members, and that brings the total number of payments to 1.19 million since inception. And the total value of payments during the week was $2.7 billion, and that makes $9 billion since inception. The average payment since inception was $7,546. Looking at the fund level data, the 10 funds with the highest number of applications received have made 795,000 payments worth a total of $5.96 billion, and the average payment from those funds was $7,664, with over 93% of payments made within 5 days. Perhaps unsurprisingly, funds in the hospitality and retail took significant hits, as well as some of the big names, and the average drawdown amount was over $9,000 in some funds, down to a much smaller amount in other funds. And the ABS reported that loneliness was the most widely reported source of personal stress for Australians during April, according to the third ABS Household Impacts of COVID-19 survey. Loneliness affected more women at 28% than men at 16%, and around 1 in 5 people, or 19%, also reported that they were experiencing difficulties maintaining a healthy lifestyle, which was more of a problem for those aged 18 to 64 at 22% than those aged 65 years and over at 9%. The survey also highlighted changes to people's lifestyles during the period early April to early May, including 22% who said that they were eating more snack food, such as chips, lollies and biscuits, 14% who said that they were consuming more alcohol, and 10% who said that they were consuming less, 58% who reported spending more time in front of their television, computer, phone or other device, and 29% who reported less frequent consumption of takeaway or delivered meals, while 38% spent more time cooking or baking. Compared with March, fewer people were taking the following precautions in late April to early May: keeping distance from people at 94%, compared with 98% in March, purchasing additional household supplies, 21%, compared with 47% in March, and purchasing additional medical supplies at 8%, compared with 29% in March. And the proportion of Australians who said that they were wearing a face mask remained about the same at 17% in March and 15% in late April to early May. And nearly half, actually 46% of all Australians, were working from home in late April and early May. Of those who were not working from home, 89% reported they couldn't due to the type of work that they did. And women were more likely than men to have been working at home at 56% compared with 38%. And 1 in 6 Australians aged 18 years and over at 17% used a telehealth service, and almost half, 43%, said that the telehealth service was a replacement for a previously arranged face-to-face appointment. And I should just add at this point that if you would like to talk to somebody about your mental health, you can contact Beyond Blue on 1300 22 4636 or Lifeline on 13 11 14. Over at The Conversation, Professors Richard Holden and Bruce Preston wrote that the costs of the shutdown are overestimated. They outweighed by $1 trillion benefits. As Australia begins to relax its COVID-19 restrictions, there's an understandable debate about how quickly that should proceed and whether lockdowns ever made sense in Australia in the first place. The sceptics, they say, argue for more rapid relaxation of containment measures and point to the economic costs of lockdowns and appeal to the cold calculus of cost-benefit analysis to conclude that the lives saved by lockdowns don't justify the economic costs incurred to do so. The numbers, though, don't stack up. To be able to weigh the value of a life against the economic costs of foregone output from lost jobs and business closures requires placing a dollar value on one person's life. This number is called the value of a statistical life. And in Australia, the government generally uses a value of $4.9 million. The United States uses a value of $10 million. So what are the benefits of the shutdown? This is the value of life saved plus any indirect economic or health benefits. And life saved are those excess lives that would have been lost if governments had relied on a strategy that allowed enough people to get infected to result in so-called herd immunity. How many extra lives would have been lost under this second strategy? Well, to answer that, we need assumptions about the virus. The internal reproductive rate of the virus, the R0, was thought to be around 2.5. That means that every two people infected were likely to infect another five. Producing an average infection rate per person of 2.5, herd immunity for COVID-19 is estimated to require roughly 60% of the population being infected before the curve begins to flatten and the peak infections fall. This happens when the reproduction rate R0 falls below 1. Because of the subsequent new infections, the total number infected over the course of the pandemic is closer to 90%. And given a population of 25 million people and assuming a fertility rate of 1%, this would produce 225,000 deaths. An assumption of a 1% fertility rate is low from the perspective of those making decisions at the onset of the pandemic, at a time when crucial and reliable data were missing. Converting those fatalities to dollars using Australian value of a statistical life of $4.9 million per life yields a cost of $1.1 trillion. In rough terms, that's the amount we have gained by shutting down the economy, provided deaths do not skyrocket when lockdown measures are relaxed and borders reopen. It's about two-fifths of 1 year's gross domestic product, which is around $1.9 trillion. So what are the costs of the shutdown? Well, those are the direct economic costs from reduced economic activity, plus the indirect social, medical, and economic costs, all measured in terms of national income. A starting point is to take the lost income that occurs from the recession that was probably already beginning. Let's assume that the downturn results in a 10% drop in gross domestic product over 2020 and 21, about $180 billion, consistent with IMF forecasts of a fall in GDP of 6.7% in 2020 and a sharp rebound of 6.1% growth in 2021, and comparable with the Reserve Bank of Australia's forecast in the latest statement on monetary policy. Comparing this cost from shutting down, about $180 billion, to the benefits of $1.1 trillion makes the case for shutdown clear. But this calculation grossly overestimates the costs of the shutdown. The recession is a consequence of both the shutdown and the pandemic. We need to attribute costs to each. Most of the economic costs of the recession are likely to be due to the pandemic itself rather than the shutdown. Even before the shutdown, economic activity was in decline. Both in Australia and internationally, air travel, restaurant bookings, and a range of other activities had fallen sharply. They were the result of a private shutdown that commenced before the mandated government shutdown. Even in a country such as Sweden, where a shutdown has not been mandatory, there has been a more than 75% reduction in movements in central Stockholm and more than a 90% reduction in travel to some domestic holiday destinations. To be generous, let's assume the costs attributed to the government-mandated part of the shutdown are half of the total costs, making their costs $90 billion. In reality, they are likely to be much less. It is hard to imagine a much bigger private shutdown not taking place had the government decided to simply let the disease rip until its spread was slowed by herd immunity. It's also important to note that the government spending of $214 billion to support the economy during the shutdown is a transfer of resources from one part of the society to another rather than just a cost. It creates neither direct costs nor benefits for society as a whole, other than the economic distortions coming from raising the revenue to service the spending. With long-term government bond rates near 1% less than inflation, the total cost of distortions is likely to be tiny. Of course, this discussion simplifies what are incredibly complex social, health, and economic questions. There are clearly further costs from both relaxing restrictions and keeping them in place. These costs are worthy of serious study and should rightly be part of a comprehensive public policy discussion. But looked at through the lens of a cost-benefit analysis, these combined effects are likely to be small relative to the value of preventing mass death. Among them are the incidence of mental health problems and domestic violence under lockdowns. They are important concerns that should be addressed by targeted and well-designed programs. Weighing against that is the evidence that economic crises are associated with declines in overall mortality rates, and while suicides rise, total mortality, including deaths from heart attacks and workplace and traffic accidents, falls. In the specific case of this pandemic, there is survey evidence based on respondents from 58 countries suggesting that strong government responses to the pandemic have been reducing worry and depression. And also, we have to acknowledge that recessions and educational disruption have health and economic costs that are unequally spread. The shutdown disproportionately impacts more disadvantaged people, including short-term casual workers, migrant workers, those with disabilities, and the homeless. This skewing will also be present in the herd immunity option. As New York City makes clear, a rapid spread of the disease also disproportionately impacts disadvantaged communities. One can only speculate about the disease burden should some of our remote indigenous communities get exposed. And to this, we should add further achievements of the shutdown, elimination of mental trauma and grief from losing our loved ones, avoiding the costs of possible longer-term implications of the disease, which we still know little about, avoiding a collapse in the capacity of the health system to deal with other emergencies through the sheer numbers of COVID-19 infected, combined with staff shortages due to illnesses. Those advocating cost-benefit analysis of this kind have to apply the principle systematically. It is difficult to see how the total of those sorts of considerations on each side of the ledger could compare to the benefits of life saved. They will be an order of magnitude, if not two, smaller. So in cold calculus of cost-benefit analysis, a highly pessimistic view of the economic costs of Australia's shutdown comes to around $90 billion. It is a small price to pay compared to the statistical value of lives the shutdown should save, which is around $1.1 trillion. It produces a simple message: the shutdown wins. The question we now face is how quickly to relax restrictions, and here too there are costs and benefits, and we need to be mindful of the economic costs of a second wave outbreak, plus mortality costs of disease spread before effective treatments or vaccine become available. And in all of this bean counting, we should remember that putting a price tag on human life is sometimes unavoidable, such as when a doctor with access to only one ventilator has to choose between two patients. But we shouldn't mistake necessity for desirability. We should seek to avoid needing to make such wrenching choices whenever possible. And housing is also being hit. According to Mortgage Business, ANZ research says the extremely uncertain housing market outlook is set to trigger a collapse in demand that could last until late 2021. ANZ Research has released a new analysis outlining its forecasts for the housing market in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. The research group stated that it's expecting property prices and construction activity to fall throughout 2020 and into 2021 before a modest recovery at the back end of 2021. An average peak to trough decline of 10% has been projected for home values across Australia's capital cities. Hobart is expected to record the sharpest declines through 2020 and 2021 at 11%. 7.2%, followed by Melbourne at 9.5%, Sydney at 8.1%, Brisbane at 4.6%, Darwin at 4.2%, Adelaide at 3.7%, Canberra at 3.2%, and Perth at just 0.2%. According to ANZ Research, the deterioration in household income could be the main driver of weakness in the housing market. Already, nearly a third of Australian households have reported a deterioration in their finances due to COVID-19. This collapse in income will create significant uncertainty for households and leave many unwilling to commit to buying or building a home, they said. And ANZ Research stated that while home loan deferrals would help prevent forced sales, the collapse in demand off the back of an extremely uncertain outlook would weigh on dwelling values. ANZ Research added that with the COVID-19 crisis prompting the closure of borders, new overseas arrivals would be limited, curtailing the largest source of population growth. And according to the group, subdued population growth will further hinder demand for housing. Net overseas migration currently accounts for around 240,000 people, or nearly two-thirds of Australia's population growth. The federal government estimates Australia's net overseas migration will fall by more than 85% in 2021 from 2018-19 levels due to international travel bans instituted in response to the virus. This drop in population growth will remove a major driver of economic growth and housing demand, at least for a period, they say. Sydney and Melbourne markets are expected to be most impacted by the decline in population growth. In the year to June 2019, Sydney's population grew by 87,000, with 85% of those newcomers being overseas migration, ANZ said. In Melbourne, the numbers are also significant, with 77,000 overseas migrants accounting for 68% of the total population growth of 113,000. Pointing to figures from property research group CoreLogic, ANZ Research noted that rental listings have risen significantly over the past few months, particularly in inner Melbourne at 36% in the month to 26th of April and Sydney at 34%. And they said that they expect the demand and supply imbalance to weigh on vacancy rates and residential rental yields over the coming years, and as a result of a less lucrative market for investors and an oversupply of housing, ANZ Research is projecting a sharp contraction in construction activity. The uncertain income outlook, as well as the sharp reduction in population growth, will curtail demand for new homes from both owner-occupiers and investors. The likely pullback in investor demand, given very challenging conditions in the rental market, will also weigh on the outlook. And so ANZ Research concluded that housing construction is already down 12% from the peak back in mid-2018, and they expect activity to continue to contract over the next year, bringing the total peak-to-trough decline to 25%. And to reinforce this, Sky News featured Robert Kilarek, the founder and CEO of the Property Expert International, who said in an interview that virtually across the board, we're seeing around a 10% correction in our market already in the last six-week period. And he also forecast that we are likely to see a 10 or 20% reduction in terms of property values. The negotiations have become certainly a big difference between the asking price and what they're purchasing the property for. From a buyer's perspective, they're thinking, well, why should I buy now when potentially I'll be able to get the same product a lot cheaper in the next 3, 6 to 12 months? Everyone said to me that the banks are being cautious, so you need to have strong financials, strong employment history to get the funding. If there's any grey area, the banks don't have an appetite for lending at all. And we're going to see a lot more distressed sales over the next 6 months. And at the moment, the market is sinking. And Louis Christopher at SQM Research followed on and said, we are very much aware of the real estate industry advising their vendors that the prices achieved in February and January are no longer achievable. I'm hearing anecdotal reports of the banks cutting new lending. It will be very interesting to see when we get to August. Will the banks roll over that moratorium on mortgage repayments, or will they start calling in loans? There are very difficult days for property investors, and we're getting zero net immigration, so we're looking at a surplus of stock. And on top of that, because short-term arrivals are zilch, it means a whole bunch of Airbnb properties have zero tenants in them right now. So those property owners are looking to move those Airbnb into longer-term leasing market, creating an additional oversupply. And one point they also made was that agents are suppressing the falls to try to keep the market afloat. Well, I would say nothing new there. But as reported in the Australian Broker, La Trobe Financial has effectively reopened Australia's debt capital markets with a $1.25 billion RMBS raising. It was the largest securitisation around the world since COVID-19 took hold in March, and according to the group, has confirmed Australian residential mortgages as a global safe harbour investment. La Trobe not only saw support from Australian institutional investors, but global investment houses in Asia, United States, and Europe. And while the federal government's Australian Office of Financial Management, the AOFM, was closely involved in the deal, investor demand saw that no AOFM investment was required. And La Trobe Chief Treasurer and Strategy Officer Martin Barry said, "We welcomed three new investors to our already 46 investor strong RMBS program and are delighted by the interest we've received both offshore and domestically as we build on our diverse investor base. We remain good stewards of other people's capital, and this enables us to obtain and maintain the trust of our clients. This is the real asset of the company. The proceeds of the issue will be used to continue writing home and business loans for Australians at a critical time in the history of the country's economy. With this RMBS transaction, we achieved competitive pricing, notwithstanding increased levels of market supply, and note participation from 15 domestic and 7 international investors from Europe, the USA, and Asia," Barry said. And finally, on a different note, the ACCC warned that Australians have lost nearly $300,000 to puppy scams this year, and scammers have been particularly targeting those seeking a furry companion during social isolation. ScamWatch has seen a recent spike in puppy scams, and in April reports were almost 5 times higher than the average, with losses on track to exceed the 2019 total of $360,000. A lot of people are stuck at home and going online to buy a pet to help them get through the loneliness of social isolation. Unfortunately, the rush to get a new pet and the unusual circumstances of COVID-19 makes it harder to work out what's real and what's a scam. Scammers set up fake websites or ads on online classifieds and social media pretending to sell sought-after dog breeds and will take advantage of the fact that you can't travel to meet the puppy in person. The scammer will usually ask for upfront payments via money transfers to pay for the pet and transport it to you. Once you've paid the initial deposit, the scammer will find new ways to ask for more money, and scammers are now using the COVID-19 pandemic to claim higher transportation costs to get across closed interstate borders or additional fees for coronavirus treatments. Unfortunately, once you make the payments, the seller will cease all contact. The most common breeds reported were Cavoodles and French Bulldogs, and most people contacted the scammers via an email address they found online. The safest option is to only buy or adopt a pet you can meet in person, and if you cannot do that during the current lockdown restrictions, consider putting the search on hold, the ACCC said. Scam websites can look quite convincing, so try not to fall for the adorable puppy pictures they post, and remember, if the price looks too good to be true, it probably is. Research the seller by running an internet search using the exact wording in the ad, and do a reverse image search for pictures of the specific puppy, as you're likely to be dealing with a scammer if you find matching images or text on multiple websites. And if you are in doubt, seek advice from a reputable breeders association, vet, or local pet shop. And the ACCC concluded, so far this year, ScamWatch has received around 2,000 reports about COVID-19 scams and reported losses that are now more than $700,000. If you think you've been scammed, contact your bank or financial institution as soon as possible. And so, from puppies to home prices, from super funds to mental health, this crisis just keeps on giving. And there will certainly be more to come in the days and weeks ahead as our coverage continues. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.